the class. If the students are late, they have to meditate out in the hall. Not bad, of course, but the kids like to meditate together. It was 3 minutes after the class bell rang, and Charlene burst through the door, Ben said. She sat down with a crash at her desk, and Ben waited a moment before walking softly over to her. I told her the bell had rung, and she'd have to do her meditation in the hall, he said. When Charlene stood to leave, Ben noticed that she had dark red paint splattered all over her dress. I told her we needed to call her mom and ask for a change of clothes, Ben said, and she just burst into tears. And through the sobs, she whispered, "It's blood." Charlene had been standing next to her uncle at a bus stop near the school when a bullet in a drive-by shooting struck him. It was her uncle's blood on her dress. Panicked, she had nowhere safe to run except to school, where she could meditate. School was her safe haven, not home, not a friend's house, but school. Schools which have become breeding grounds for drugs, violence, and crime are transformed through quiet time. Meditative moment, a parallel stream of consciousness. Russell Brand had been a heroin addict for more than 14 years, and he was 5 years clean from drugs and alcohol when I met him. He reached out because he was producing a documentary on his life's journey and was interested in learning to meditate as part of the project. I mentioned this to a friend. "Be careful," she said. "He's a very funny guy, but see if he'll take you seriously." Russell was staying at the Soho House in New York. We met in the restaurant. He's easy to spot, so I waved to him, and he came over and put his face about 3 inches from mine, staring me right in the eye. "Are you going to teach me transcendental meditation?" "It depends on if you have the time," I said. His face completely softened, and he gave the look of someone truly open and ready. "I've been searching for the experience of timeless my whole life," he said. "I have as much time as you want." I taught Russell about 2 weeks later, and we've remained close friends since. That was almost 7 years ago. Russell said, "The idea of meditation was challenging because I had this initial response, which now I recognize is quite a cliched one. I don't know if I'll be able to meditate because my mind is so busy and I'm always thinking. But it's part of my life now. I've not been able to say I've never missed a session, but I've been good with it. It's become part of my identity." I would argue that even addiction, such as I had, was its own form of spiritual quest. It's a sense of disease, unease, and dissatisfaction that led me to chemical dependency. Since meditating regularly, the way I see the world and what I want for myself has changed. I always have to be mindful and point out that it's not, "Oh yeah, I used to be that crazy drug addict and womanizer, and now I'm just basically sitting around with a blanket wrapped around me looking at a cool, calm lake thinking George Harrison lyrics." I'm not. I've still got desire in me, fear, lust. I'm full of human, flesh-based stuff. But what's happened is that a neglected aspect of me has been awoken and cultivated through this meditative practice. Meditation for me is a continual parallel stream of consciousness, ever-present, usually ignored, that I can step into at any time. Often I like to engage in illusion and self-deception. It's fine to take drugs. I deserve to be famous. Or sex and money are great. But beneath these temporal and sensory distractions, the limitless flow abides, like space, like time, misunderstood due to its boundless nature. Without meditation, we're worse than apes. Apes that can speak and are aware of their apeness. There ain't enough bananas in the world for me to deal with that. I must add a personal note here that Russell, as well as the other artists and performers who I've included in this book, have been incredibly generous with their time and resources. Russell, who is the author of the bestseller Recovery, Freedom from Our Addictions, is working with the David Lynch Foundation to bring meditation to adults and teens who are battling substance use disorder of all types. He is helping to save lives. There are more than 24 million Americans addicted to alcohol and drugs, including opioids, according to the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. That's approximately one in every 10 Americans over the age of 12, roughly equivalent to the entire population of Texas. My friend Peter Dodge, like Russell Brand, learned to meditate to help take hold of his addictive behavior, in Peter's case, toward alcohol. "The history of my addiction mirrors that of many alcoholics," said Peter, the head of a global information services firm in Washington, D.C. "I was hooked from the very first drink I took at 13. I excelled in high school and attended a top college, but drinking to excess was a constant, and I knew that I was different. Although I tried to fight it, my drinking worsened in my 20s. To complicate matters further, Peter's alcoholism coincided with the progression of what he later learned was bipolar disorder. The confluence of these illnesses would have been more than enough to cause great destruction, Peter told me. But then add in an improperly prescribed antidepressant that made me manic in the extreme, and you have the perfect recipe for disaster. In effect, I was criminally insane, and I behaved in ways during my late 20s that were in no way reflections of my true character and that will haunt me forever. I would not have reached that point if traditional approaches to recovery had worked for me, said Peter, but they didn't. Peter then learned about TM from listening to the Howard Stern Show. Laugh if you must, but Howard's endorsement led me to discover the fact that he is not the only master of his craft who meditates. A results-oriented business guy, Peter looked into TM and was impressed with the number of CEOs, including hedge fund leader Ray Dalio, who credit the practice with giving them an edge. I pursued TM instruction because I thought it would make me a more effective operator of my business, Peter told me. Very quickly, however, I saw how TM could support my efforts to stay sober. I equate TM to music. We are not sure why it works for us, but it definitely does. Whereas music just makes us feel good, though, TM has the ability to reconfigure our minds in a healthy way completely. After so-called mainstream methods of treatment for alcohol addiction, including AA, had not worked for him, Peter developed a multi-pronged approach to achieving and maintaining sobriety. Peter is now the founder, board chairman, and president of the Peter G. Dodge Foundation, a philanthropic organization dedicated to helping people lead lives free from the effects of alcohol addiction. Peter told me, "Over the last 3.5 years of meditating as regularly as I could, I have experienced the dissolution of a giant bolus of anger, anxiety, neurosis, and insecurity. It has healed my mind in a way that nothing else could have, and in doing so, has relieved me of the need to self-medicate." Amazing as that is, Peter was quick to add that this is not the only reason that TM is the most important tool in his toolkit. "My daily meditations keep me mindful of the kind of man I want to be, which keeps me using my other tools, which creates a virtuous cycle. Every time I meditate, the distance between me and that first drink, the one that is the true problem, grows a little bit." In 2015, Peter's foundation funded a feasibility study on TM and alcohol use disorder, conducted by the Friends Research Institute at the Avery Road Treatment Center in Rockville, Maryland. Early results show that regular TM practice may help to prevent relapse after alcohol treatment. Previous research has found that TM reduces anxiety, depression, tobacco use, and alcohol and drug use. I pride myself in thinking big with our work. I thought I'd done that. And then I learned I needed to think even bigger. A couple of years ago, I was meeting with some civic and community leaders in Newark, New Jersey, to develop a large research protocol for the public schools that would provide quiet time to all the students, teachers, administrators, and parents in the city who wanted to learn. The study would investigate the impact of quiet time on stress, health, behavior, and academic performance, as well as teacher burnout, absenteeism, and school district health costs. We completed the plan, and I went to speak to Richard, who headed up a large hedge fund in Midtown Manhattan, to discuss possible financial support. I quite proudly plunked the thick proposal on his desk and announced that we had a plan to address the damaging influence of trauma and stress on education in Newark. He glanced at the title page, with Newark emblazoned across the top, and pushed the papers aside. "Do you believe," Richard asked, "that trauma is a major health crisis among the young?" "Yes," I said. "Do you believe that quiet time can help address that problem?" "Yes, I do," I said as politely as I could to hide my impatience. "That's the reason for the proposal." "Then why are you thinking so small? Why a plan just for kids in Newark? Why aren't you thinking for every child in America, in fact the world? If you came to me 70 years ago with a proposal to cure childhood polio," Richard said, "would you have shown me a plan that would only help the kids in Newark?" "Of course not. Come back with a bigger plan." Richard was right, of course. When it comes to a new medicine that has been shown to effectively address a terrible epidemic, the delivery strategy is global, never just local. For the first 10 years of the David Lynch Foundation, we focused on implementing programs and evaluating the outcomes when TM was introduced in entire schools, veteran service organizations, women's shelters, treatment programs for substance use disorders, juvenile justice centers, HIV clinics, as well as Fortune 100 companies, professional athletic teams, military bases, and other governmental organizations. The data that have come in, as you have seen, are quite heartening and quite compelling. Now, in our second decade, our focus has shifted naturally to scalability. How can we bring the benefits of meditation to as many people as possible? To this end, we are working with a bipartisan group of members of Congress and leaders of government agencies to secure support for these programs, and, I might add, other innovative, evidence-based programs at work, so they can be offered on a large scale. At the same time, we are working with medical schools and research institutions to evaluate the impact of these initiatives, including for cost savings. And we continue to partner with a growing number of foundations and philanthropists to expand our initiatives right now. Bridgewater Associates founder Ray Dalio and his wife Barbara have given me key insight into the minds of true benefactors. It comes down to the lesson we hopefully all learn from our parents or mentors growing up. When you have it to give, give. Ray has personally helped to underwrite the cost of many hundreds of people in his company to learn to meditate, and he and Barbara have helped many thousands of others learn TM through their generous donations to the David Lynch Foundation. "I started with nothing," Ray said, "and I've been very lucky to live in a country that has provided me with lots of opportunity, and I happened to be in a career that led me to make a lot of money. I was faced with the question of, what should I do with that money before I die?" he said. "I don't want to give a lot of money to my kids, because the thing I want them to have more than anything else is strength, and that comes from struggling. At the same time, I get a tremendous kick out of having a big impact on people and causes, where the marginal impact of the money I am providing is huge. Obviously, it seems the sensible and exciting thing to do. My family members have experienced the same benefits from TM as I have. So how could we not support giving TM to stressed, at-risk students in underserved schools and veterans who suffer the nightmare of post-traumatic stress?" Meditative moment. Back to my most natural state. Lena Dunham is the creator of the groundbreaking HBO series Girls and a best-selling author. She has been meditating since she was 9 years old. Her parents meditated, and Lena says her mother, artist Lori Simmons, brought her to a TM teacher to help her with what looked like the beginning of obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. I was fortunate to give Lena a refresher course in TM as she was finishing up her work on Girls. She talked to me about TM's impact on her creative process and how it helps her get out of her own way. Lena says, "At the most root level, what meditation does for me is bring me back to my most natural state and remind me of what my value is in the world. There's all this stuff that's set up in the world to distract us from our most basic self and our most basic instinct. It's so easy to get caught up in challenges and ambition, and there's so much fear and anxiety that accompany modern life. For me, meditation is the thing that shows me what we all are. It sounds so mystical, but it's actually so basic. A lot of people think, and I used to be one of these people, that they're creative because they're suffering, when really that is actually so antithetical to making things you're proud of. There are so many people who are caught up in the idea that if they're happy in their family life, or they're in love, or if they aren't drinking themselves into oblivion every night, that somehow the magical thing that allows them to make art is going to disappear. I know I fell victim to that idea. Now I realize I've actually been creating in spite of all of that, not because of it. It's funny, when I mention meditation, people's eyes kind of light up, because there are all these people who are clearly looking for anything that will give them superhuman productivity and power. So initially what attracts them to meditation is their sort of baser instincts, but once they do it, they find these other things coming to light. They go in saying, I want to be able to sleep less, make more money, and have it all. Now they're meditating, and suddenly they have insight into their other behaviors that they wouldn't have otherwise. I was at the airport flipping through some trashy magazine waiting for my flight, and I saw this article saying, try the technique all the stars are doing. And then there was a description of transcendental meditation. I guess whatever has to happen to get meditation out in the world, but it's so funny when TM is on the same page as diet tips. As I have learned to think bigger, people often ask me what I would like to see happen with TM in America and the world. I would like everyone to know what the technique is and to have access to it if they would like to learn, either through a TM center in their community or through their company, school, or university, or through a community health center, veteran service organization, and so forth. For many people with an interest, however, time is a confounding issue. Time to find out about it, time to be instructed, time to meditate. Fortunately, the world is changing, and more businesses now have meditation rooms along with gyms, and school teachers are able to use their faculty lounges for afternoon meditations. 10 years ago, that might have sounded ludicrous, but no more, because we ignore the deadly ramifications of stress at our own peril. Making it easy for employees to take a few minutes out of a busy day to meditate makes good sense for health, productivity, and the bottom line. As you now know, when you are instructed in TM, you learn from a professionally trained teacher who will work with you for as many hours as it takes to ensure you are practicing it correctly and gaining benefits over the course of your entire lifetime. Sometimes people say, if this is so good for the world, it should be free. I agree, it should be free. But I also agree that education is good for the world, but someone has to pay the school teachers. Food is good for the world, but someone has to pay the farmers. The nominal course fee, which varies according to the ability to pay, helps to cover TM teachers' salaries, as well as rent and administrative costs of running a TM center. That said, there are people for whom money is tight. Fortunately, under the leadership of Dr. Hagelin, the nonprofit TM organization in the United States is quite generous, providing grants, scholarships, and loans to help people in financial need whenever available. Dr. Hagelin's team is also working with employee assistance programs, insurance providers, and government agencies to provide coverage for the TM course fee, just as these agencies would with any other evidence-based treatment modality. And for people who suffer from trauma and toxic stress and who have no access to funds, the David Lynch Foundation continues to raise support from corporations, foundations, and philanthropists so we can provide scholarships for the many millions of people who are desperate to learn. That is our strategy, and the response has been excellent. Soon everyone who wants to learn how to meditate will be able to do so. That was Maharishi's goal back in 1958 when he first started teaching TM. And that is the same goal today. Meditative moment. Opening the door for stillness and strength. For Tony Nader, MD, PhD, the ravages of war were not something he saw in movies or read about in books. He saw it firsthand. Born and raised in Lebanon, he attended medical school in Beirut during some of the bloodiest periods of the 15-year Lebanese Civil War. He earned his medical degree from American University there, and then moved to the United States, where he attended MIT and earned a PhD in brain and cognitive science. He also served as clinical and research fellow in neurology at the Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, and the assistant director of the Clinical Research Center at MIT. Dr. Nader first met Maharishi in 1979 at MIT. Over decades, a unique, trusted, mentor-apprentice relationship developed. Before Maharishi passed in 2008, he asked Dr. Nader to oversee the entire global TM organization. Dr. Nader told me, "I was studying pre-med at American University in Beirut in 1975 at the start of the Civil War. There were shootings and bombs. People were getting kidnapped because of their religion. Sometimes for months at a time, I couldn't travel from the university across the city to visit my parents because there was so much violence. During those days, I was searching for meaning amidst the destruction, looking for a way to meditate. I tried a concentration technique for a little while, and I also did some breathing exercises, but I didn't get anywhere. Then I heard about transcendental meditation from a friend and decided to try it out. Right away, I experienced something I had been seeking for a long time, transcendence, a deep inner calm, a deep inner bliss, and a great expansion of awareness. It was tremendously satisfying. I had more energy and clarity to study better, to be more focused and accomplish more. Most important, TM helped me remain settled inside, even though I was surrounded by fear and loss and violence. I opened a TM club at American University, and I got my family and friends to learn to meditate as well. Living in a war zone, I had a desire to understand exactly what happens in the minds of people that would make them want to fight. I specialized in psychiatry at medical school, and that gave me some insight, but not enough. I became a TM teacher after I completed medical school, and then I entered a PhD program in neuroscience at MIT. I wanted to better understand the science of TM in the brain so I could do more than just treat a disease, but really improve a person's health, really develop his or her creative potential. Not just in limited ways from the chemical neurophysiological level, but from the unlimited level of the human mind. I conducted research on neurochemistry, neuroendocrinology, and the relationship between diet, age, and behavior, and neurotransmitter and hormonal activity, and on the role of neurotransmitter precursors in medicine. When I met Maharishi at MIT, it was the beginning of what I can best describe as an apprenticeship that lasted decades. I learned from Maharishi the deep connections between the ancient Vedic science of consciousness and the form and function of the human brain and physiology. I traveled all over the world and spoke with leaders in government, medicine, education, business, and defense about the science of consciousness. Over time, Maharishi gave me more and more responsibility for the knowledge and the administration of the global TM organization. It was nothing I ever imagined coming my way. People often ask me about Maharishi. I think Maharishi's achievements speak best for who he was. I believe history will recognize Maharishi as the foremost scientist of consciousness, the one who revived the simplicity and naturalness of transcendental meditation. He opened the door for everyone, no matter his or her education, nationality, or religion, to experience real inner stillness, transcendence, and to develop real inner strength, higher states of consciousness. This has been Maharishi's great contribution to the field of science, to the study of human consciousness, and to life. A reporter from the Associated Press was interviewing Maharishi for a feature story about the 50th anniversary of his TM organization back in June 2007. I had taught the reporter to meditate a few days before and had the opportunity to sit in on the conversation. After a series of almost perfunctory questions, the reporter asked Maharishi about his overly optimistic view of the impact of meditation on people suffering from a host of traumas and stress-related disorders. Such suffering had existed for centuries, the reporter said, and was not going away anytime soon. How then could Maharishi be so hopeful? Maharishi thought for a minute, nodded, and said, "Darkness is just the absence of light. Turn on the light, and the darkness disappears. You can have a room that's been in darkness for one day, and you can have a room that's been in darkness for 1,000 years. When you turn on a light in each room, the darkness disappears just as fast. Like that is the impact of transcendental meditation in the life of the individual, and by extension, the whole of society. I'm incredibly positive about what TM can do for you and our larger world, mainly because I've experienced it firsthand for nearly 50 years, and because I've seen its dramatic impact in the lives of thousands of people I've personally taught, some of whom live in the darkest, most violent, most dire conditions imaginable. Should you choose to learn to meditate, I offer my full support, and the full support of every other TM teacher in the world, as you begin this journey to experience and express the boundless reservoir of creativity and intelligence that lies within you. It's such a simple thing, but it's also incredibly powerful. Enjoy. If you'd like more information on transcendental meditation, please visit www.tm.org. And if you'd like more information on the David Lynch Foundation, please visit www.davidlynchfoundation.org.
Strength in Stillness, The Power of Transcendental Meditation, was written by Bob Roth with Kevin Carr O'Leary and read by Bob Roth. It was recorded by Ryan Lissy, Noriko Okabe, and Maxwell Cicchino. Editing and post-production by Steven Strassman. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Elliot Rombach. Strength in Stillness was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Strength in Stillness, The Power of Transcendental Meditation, is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.